Imagine you're, on vacation in Rio de Janeiro.
Sounds pretty good right about now.
Right. So you just landed at the airport, you rent a car, and you plug your hotel's address into Google Maps.
As we all do.
Exactly. So a blue line pops up on the screen, calculating the absolute fastest route. You put the car in drive, and you just follow the line.
Standard routine.
But what you don't know, and what the app, definitely doesn't tell you, is that this mathematically perfect route goes straight through one of the most dangerous favelas in the city at night.
Oh, wow. That's not good.
No, it's a real story documented in our sources today. These tourists were actually attacked in their car, all because the navigation system was just optimizing purely for speed.
It had zero context for human safety.
Exactly. It didn't fail at math. It failed at reality.
Which is such a stark illustration of what happens when we blindly trust an optimization engine to navigate a complex human environment.
Yeah,
Like, the system doesn't know what a vacation is. It doesn't understand fear or danger. It just processes the data it was fed.
and that tension, right, between flawless data processing and actual lived human context, that's the foundation of today's deep dive. Welcome, everyone.
Glad to be here.
So today we're unpacking a stack of keynotes, essays, and transcripts from the futurist Gerard Leonhard.
Yeah, he makes some really compelling points.
He argues that we're living in this era of permachange, where science fiction is rapidly becoming science fact. And his core thesis is pretty bold.
Very bold. He basically says if you try to compete with machines on efficiency or logic or data processing, you're going to lose.
You will lose. Full stop.
Right. So the ultimate survival strategy in this AI-dominated world is to actually double down on the things that make us uniquely human.
Which means we really need to completely dismantle how we define knowledge and, well, how we spend our workdays.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you map out a typical weekday morning for a lot of knowledge workers, it essentially mirrors a line of computer code.
Right, the whole if-then loop.
Exactly. If the alarm rings, brew coffee. If the inbox has unread messages, generate standard responses. Process input, output deliverable.
We've literally spent decades trying to turn ourselves into hyper-efficient machines.
We have, and Gerard's argument suggests that any part of your job that feels robotic is already on the verge of obsolescence.
So if you're listening right now, I really want you to evaluate your own routine. How much of your day is spent just functioning like a processor?
It's a tough question to ask yourself.
It is, but to understand why this shift is happening, we have to establish what artificial intelligence actually is, functionally speaking.
Right. And Demis Hassabis, the CEO of DeepMind, provides a really good working definition in the materials.
What does he call it again?
He calls AI a system that turns data and information into knowledge.
The mechanism there is super important.
Yeah, because we're looking at systems like IBM Watson, for example, that can ingest the entirety of Wikipedia, synthesize all the cross-references, and just output a summarized answer in seconds.
They pass the bar exam, they generate functional code from a single text prompt.
Exactly. The AI has completely mastered the aggregation of explicit knowledge.
But the sources draw a very, very hard line between intelligence and consciousness.
They do, and it's a crucial distinction. Intelligence in this framework is just the ability to solve a problem or reach a goal.
Whereas consciousness is the ability to actually feel, to experience things, to have intrinsic values.
Right. AI has factual knowledge, but it doesn't have a physical body. It's never felt a sunburn or the panic of missing a mortgage payment or, the nuance of a really good joke.
But we constantly project consciousness onto competence.
All the time. Because an AI can output this brilliant essay on existential philosophy in 3 seconds, we just assume it understands
No, it
existence.
doesn't.
Not at all. It's just a highly competent lookup engine predicting the next logical word based on a massive historical database.
So let's look at the danger of confusing those two things. The sources mentioned this proposal discussed by a past U.S. administration to essentially replace the World Health Organization with an AI system.
Right, the WHO AI proposal.
Yeah. And to be clear to the listener, we are looking at this strictly from an operational systems design standpoint, completely independent of any politics.
Purely as a thought experiment on systems.
Exactly. So if you hand over global pandemic response or societal health initiatives to a machine, you are creating the ultimate black box.
And a black box is basically a system that makes decisions where the human operators literally cannot decipher how the algorithm arrived at its conclusion.
Right. So if an AI is running global health and it calculates that the absolute most efficient way to stop a virus is to permanently lock down a specific continent.
And just completely halt all their food supply chains.
Yes, the math might be flawless, the virus might be contained, but the human suffering is catastrophic.
Because the machine doesn't weigh the psychological or economic destruction.
It has no lived context for what starvation or isolation actually feels like.
And that highlights exactly why humans have to remain the final arbiters of complex societal issues. The algorithm can give you the epidemiological models, sure.
But the human has to apply the contextual judgment. The machine is for answers.
And the human is for questions.
Which brings me to this major flaw in how we've structured human development. Whenever I read about these hyper-competent AI systems, I always think of that scene in the movie Minority Report.
Oh, the helicopter scene.
Yes. The character needs to escape, so he instantly downloads a helicopter pilot program straight into his brain, and like 5 seconds later, he's flying a chopper.
It's a great visual for explicit learning.
But traditional education has treated human beings exactly like that for a century. We sit kids in a lecture hall, ask them to download information into their biological hard drive, and then regurgitate it on a test.
Because we built an educational system designed to produce reliable functionaries for the industrial age, You had to memorize the manual so you could operate the machinery without making an error.
But if a literal machine can now read the manual and operate the machinery perfectly, that entire educational model just collapses.
It really does. GERD has this stark warning in the sources. He says, if you work like a robot will take your job. If you learn like a robot, you will never have a job.
Wow. So the proposed pivot here is moving from a pure STEM curriculum, science, technology, engineering, and math, to STEM plus SECI.
Right, SECI, which is an acronym GERD coined for humanity, ethics, creativity, and imagination.
But let's test the logic of that for a second. How on earth do you measure imagination in a school system or a corporate training program?
It's a fair question.
Right, like we know how to test math. You got the equation right or wrong. But you can't exactly put a Scantron sheet over a student's empathy.
No, you can't. You measure it by shifting the evaluation from problem solving to problem framing.
Okay, unpack that a bit.
So in a world where the AI can solve the equation instantly, the value of the human isn't in calculating the answer. The value is in looking at a community, observing a friction point, and having the imagination to ask, is this actually the right problem to be solving in the first place?
Oh, so you're giving the machine the proper target.
Precisely. Let's look at the timeline GERD provides. He argues that by the year 2030, standard routine knowledge work will be heavily commoditized.
Because you won't need to learn traditional syntax programming if you can just speak to your wristwatch in plain English and ask it to architect an app.
Exactly. Or you might not need a standard structural engineer for basic projects because an automated system could mathematically optimize and 3D print a bridge.
So purely possessing technical skills won't protect you from automation.
Not anymore.
And this directly contradicts a very loud narrative in the tech sector right now. The sources include this claim from Elon Musk, where he argues that AI is going to revolutionize education because every single child will basically have an Einstein-like perfect AI tutor in their pocket.
Yeah, and GERD fundamentally rejects that premise. Calling an AI tutor Einstein-like completely misrepresents what actually made Einstein a genius.
Right, he wasn't just a biological calculator.
No, he possessed deep, intuitive leaps of imagination. He was a polymath. He played the violin to help him think about physics.
While an AI tutor is really just an aggregator of public data.
Exactly. It's just going to feed a student the statistical average of what humanity has already published, complete with all of our historical biases, by the way.
Let's apply that to the Khan Academy vision discussed in the materials, where they want to give every student an AI teaching assistant.
The nail gun analogy.
Yes. I look at this through the analogy in the sources. Giving a student an AI tutor isn't some magical educational fix. It's like giving a construction worker a nail gun.
The tool drastically increases efficiency, sure, but it doesn't impart wisdom.
Right. A nail gun lets you shoot 100 nails a minute instead of swinging a hammer. But handing someone a nail gun does not teach them architectural design.
It doesn't teach them what kind of house to build.
Or whether the soil can even support the foundation, or who's going to live in that house. The tool only accelerates the execution.
And this requires us to understand the hierarchy of knowledge. What you're describing with the nail gun, or the AI tutor, is the mastery of explicit knowledge.
The hard facts.
Right. The objective data, the codified steps required to execute a task. AI absolutely dominates explicit knowledge. But humans have to move up the pyramid to tacit knowledge.
Okay, so how does tacit knowledge actually function in a modern workplace?
Well, tacit knowledge is subjective, experiential wisdom. It's highly contextual and incredibly difficult to write down in a manual.
Can you give an example?
Sure. Imagine two CEOs sitting in a boardroom negotiating a high-stakes merger.
Go.
The AI can instantly analyze 10 years of financial data, market trends, risk probabilities. That is explicit.
Got it.
But it takes human tacit knowledge to read the micro-expressions of the other CEO, to understand the cultural history of their company, to sense the tension in the room and build the actual emotional trust required to sign the contract.
Because trust isn't a mathematical equation.
Exactly. It's embodied.
You know, the pace at which we need to make this transition to tacit knowledge is what I find the most daunting.
Oh, the speed is terrifying.
The sources emphasize that technological change is no longer linear. It's exponential. And human brains are biologically terrible at comprehending exponential growth.
Because we're wired for linear environments. If you walk across the savanna, your progress is steady and predictable.
Yeah, GERD uses a really brilliant mathematical illustration for this. If you take 30 linear steps, just walking, normally you move about 30 meters down the street.
Right.
But if you take 30 exponential steps, where every step doubles the distance of the last, so 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, that 30th step doesn't put you at the end of the block.
It equals 26 trips around the entire world.
It's mind-blowing.
And the sheer scale of that acceleration really explains the economic projections in the sources. GERD notes that 70% of the jobs that will exist in 2030 haven't even been invented yet.
We're trying to prepare a workforce for industries that literally do not exist.
And it isn't just a digital shift either. We are simultaneously navigating three distinct revolutions. The digital revolution is the obvious one.
But the sources also highlight the sustainability revolution. Transitioning the global infrastructure to a green economy is estimated to be, what, a $20 trillion shift?
Something massive like that, yeah. And the third is what GERD calls the purpose revolution, which is driven largely by shifting demographics.
Millennials and Gen Y.
Right. They're inheriting significant economic and cultural power, and their operating system is fundamentally different from previous generations. They are driven by the five P's.
Which are people, planet, purpose, peace, and prosperity.
Exactly.
But let's look at the economic mechanics of that for a second. Why would a massive multinational corporation care about purpose if their entire mandate is just to generate shareholder value?
Because the market forces are actually demanding it now. If a company operates with a singular focus on profit, completely ignoring the environmental or social impact, they're facing a corporate death wish.
It's not just a PR issue anymore.
No, it's a talent acquisition issue. Highly skilled workers in this new economy simply will not work for organizations that lack a broader societal purpose.
And consumers are increasingly using their purchasing power to punish unethical companies.
Right. So prosperity is now inextricably linked to the other four P's.
Which means the metrics for corporate success are becoming distinctly human. And this brings us to this neologism GERD Leonhard coined, which serves as the counterweight to everything we've talked about so far. Androithms.
Right, which is a play on the word algorithms. If an algorithm is a step-by-step mathematical procedure for calculation, an androithm represents the deeply human traits that machines cannot replicate.
Empathy, compassion, negotiation, observation, intuition. Just the chaotic, beautiful mess of being biological.
Yeah, and this ties into Moravec's paradox.
I love this concept.
It's so relevant here. It's the observation that what is incredibly difficult for a human to do is effortless for a machine and vice versa.
Like calculating pi to a million decimal places is impossible for me, but it takes a computer a fraction of a second.
Exactly. However, walking across a cluttered living room without tripping.
Or reading the emotional temperature of a really tense meeting and diffusing it with a joke.
Right. That requires massive, complex sensorimotor and emotional processing that machines struggle to even simulate.
But we've spent decades trying to compete with machines on their side of the paradox.
Trying to become better calculators. But we need to retreat to our side of the paradox and cultivate our androrhythms.
I have to challenge the current trajectory of the tech industry based on this, though.
Go for it.
If our value is in being distinctly human, why are companies like Samsung pouring billions into developing digital humans or avatars like Neon?
Oh, I know.
Why is the stated goal of OpenAI to achieve artificial general intelligence? You know, a machine that can think and reason exactly like a human.
Yeah.
We're spending unimaginable resources to build artificial humans. Isn't that kind of like inviting an invasive species into our own ecosystem?
It's a great point. And the drive toward AGI often stems from this massive philosophical blind spot in Silicon Valley. You constantly hear tech executives claim that organisms are just algorithms.
Right. They view biology as just complex software
that they think can eventually be reverse engineered and replicated in silicon. And GERD calls this one of the most dangerous and ridiculous statements imaginable.
Because it completely reduces the human experience to just data processing.
Exactly. Organisms are not algorithms. A human being is grounded in physical experience, in biology, in a chaotic and unpredictable reality.
Yeah.
When we try to build machines that act human, we really blur the line between a tool and an entity. Tools are supposed to augment our humanity, not replace our need for each other.
So how do we translate this high-level philosophy into practical action? If you're listening to this on your commute or, you know, while you're making dinner, how do you actually future-proof yourself starting tomorrow morning?
Well, the sources reference a great quote from the futurist Alvin Toffler. He says, "The illiterate of the 21st century will not be those who cannot read and write, but those who cannot learn, unlearn, and relearn."
Cognitive flexibility is the new literacy.
Yes.
Though the unlearning part might honestly be the hardest, we have to unlearn the instinct to just be efficient.
And to facilitate that, GERD proposes a daily habit he calls the future mindset. The action item is to spend exactly 45 minutes every single day actively sitting in the future.
But let's clarify the mechanics of that. Spending 45 minutes scrolling through tech gossip on social media or reading dystopian headlines, that doesn't make you a futurist?
No, it just makes you anxious.
Right. So what does sitting in the future practically entail?
It means dedicating focused time to reading, studying, and synthesizing emerging trends outside of your immediate daily inbox.
Give me a tangible example.
So if you're in supply chain management, you aren't just reading about today's shipping delays. You are spending 45 minutes studying how 3D printing might eliminate the need to ship certain parts globally in 5 years.
Ah. I see.
You're analyzing macro trends and asking, what does this mean for my specific workflow? And if you do this consistently, you organically become the resident visionary in your organization.
You stop reacting to change and start anticipating.
Exactly.
And this also requires a massive shift in how we acquire information. We have to move from just-in-case learning to just-in-time learning.
Right, because for generations, we operated on just-in-case learning. You memorize the state capitals or historical dates or the quadratic formula just in case you ever needed them for a meeting or a test.
But now the AI holds the entirety of just-in-case knowledge. It's universally abundant and instantly accessible.
Which means the new skill is just-in-time learning. This is the ability to dynamically acquire, evaluate, and synthesize new information the exact moment a novel problem arises.
So you don't need to memorize the data beforehand.
No, you just need to know how to query the system, filter the output for bias, and apply it to the context.
I have to play devil's advocate here, though.
Let's hear it.
Let's look at a 10-year-old student today. If they rely entirely on just-in-time learning, like if they use an AI to structure their essays, solve their math equations, summarize their reading assignments, aren't we basically bypassing the cognitive struggle required to actually build neural pathways?
It's a very common fear.
Right. Doesn't the friction of just-in-case learning actually teach you how to think?
It is a vital concern, but historically, society panics every time we externalize a cognitive function. Mm. We ask the exact same question when the calculator was introduced to classrooms and when the internet made encyclopedias obsolete. The friction doesn't disappear. It just shifts.
How so?
The cognitive struggle is no longer about gathering and retaining the facts. The struggle is now about orchestration and judgment.
Okay, that makes sense.
Embrace the technology, but do not become it. Use the AI tool to clear out the mundane robotic routines. Let it grade the multiple choice tests. Let it summarize the 50-page regulatory PDF. Let it write the boilerplate code.
And by doing that, you free up massive amounts of mental bandwidth.
Exactly. The mandate is that you must use that newly freed space to focus on non-routine judgment calls, creative leaps, and interpersonal connections.
We must never put hyper-efficiency over humanity. If the AI saves you 2 hours a day, you don't use those 2 hours to just process more emails.
Please don't.
You use them to actually talk to your team, to strategize, to deploy your algorithms.
The narrative of the future must be a human narrative supported by technology. It simply cannot be a technology narrative where human beings are just along for the ride as bystanders.
We absolutely have agency in how this plays out.
Mm-hmm.
GERD notes in the materials that if you're a pessimist about the future, you're essentially letting someone else create that future for you.
Right. Optimists, by definition, act. And through their actions, they engineer the reality they want to live in.
It all comes down to intent. The technology is agnostic. Our application of it determines the outcome.
Completely agree.
Which leads to a final thought I want to leave you with today, drawing from the legendary thinker Buckminster Fuller.
Oh, great quote coming up.
He said that we are meant to be the architects of the future, not its victims. So test yourself with this scenario tomorrow morning.
Okay, what's the scenario?
When your alarm rings and you start your routine, imagine that your specific job title has vanished. An AI can now execute the explicit functions of your role flawlessly and for free.
Okay, slightly terrifying, but go on.
If you could only be hired for your humanity, your empathy, your ability to frame the right questions, your capacity to navigate human trust, what would your new value be to the world?
I love that. It forces you to identify what is truly irreplaceable about your presence in a room.
It's time to break out of the if-then statements. The machines have mastered the processing. The creation is up to you. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. Stay curious, stay human, and we will see you next time.